This is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. You're listening to Storytime, episode 20 of 9 O'Clock Horses. Jenny's surgery seemed to arouse curiosity when we visited a new pediatrician. It was only then that I realized it was a modern miracle that she survived. Without the surgery, she would have died. Since I had been convinced all through the pregnancy that I would have a son and his name would be David, we had given very little thought to a girl's name, which, of course, was a little naive, to say the least. I had always liked the name Jennifer, but since Joseph said it was proper to name a child after a deceased relative, he wanted his aunt's name, Esther. We compromised, and she was named in the temple Jennifer Esther. It was so nice to see Joseph's cousin Eva and her husband Sal at the naming in the temple, and even his aunt Cecilia and Uncle Louis came. I told Eva I would cook a meal for them afterwards. "Oh, that will be nice," she said. I had been making a spaghetti dinner, and meatballs were always everyone's favorite, I thought. But for a change, I decided it would be a clam bake with a nice clam sauce over spaghetti. When they arrived, I was in the kitchen with Eva. She was talking to me. "So," she said, "so what are you doing? What are you making?" I said, "Well, I think I'm going to do clams this time." She said, "Oh, Amelia, no, you can't serve clams. It's treif." "Treif." "Of course," I panicked. Then I remembered. "It's bottom fish, isn't it? No, it's not very kosher, is it? Sorry. What shall I do?" She thought for a moment. "Tell you what," she said, "you keep the spaghetti going, and I'll run to the shops to buy some sauce. You've got the salad and the bread. That will do nicely." I gave her a big hug. "Oh, thank goodness you caught this catastrophe in time." "Well, you weren't to know," she suddenly laughed. "You know, Cecilia and Louis are all about kosher. They would not have eaten your dinner." She left the kitchen still laughing. I sighed, knowing I'd have to research Jewish recipes a little more carefully if I was going to entertain. While Joseph's relatives were there with us that day, I expected Joseph to talk about his surgery. But he didn't, and I daredn't mention it either. I wondered at that time if any of them knew that Joseph had a congenital heart problem. Cecilia was his mother's sister. Would they not have discussed it when he was a child? Well, the fact that the Levines lived in New York and Cecilia and Eva had settled in California, well, that might have had something to do with it. I was never to know. But again, it seemed a strange way to be. There were secrets in that family, for sure. The decisions for Joseph having surgery still hovered on the horizon. It's something we couldn't speak of. We knew it was there, had to be done. Even second opinions did nothing to reassure us that all would be well without it. I wanted Joseph to call his parents with all that had happened. Surely they would want to know about Jenny and the fact that he was planning to have open-heart surgery. It seemed wrong to me that he had never been in touch with his mother or father since we left New York, and sadly, they had made no effort to contact him either. Could they really just disown their son? It was beyond me. But then I didn't know the rules of their religious beliefs. I just decided that I would have to call them if Joseph didn't. What would be wrong with that? When I mentioned what I planned to do, Joseph said, "Don't do that. Don't call them, please. Remember, they were the ones who disowned me. They're not interested. They're not interested to you or me. We're not part of their life." I shook my head. Joseph was bitter about his parents, that was for sure. We had made plans to go to England to see my folks. Passport for Joseph and Jenny, even at 2 months old, and mine had been renewed. Dr. Ivans at Long Beach Hospital had told us that since we had it all planned, we should go as soon as possible. "Do it now, Boychik," he said. Go now. Come back and have the procedure. He added, you should take advantage of the new techniques with open heart surgeries. It's so advanced now. Getting this mitral valve will save your life. But go on your trip to England first. Okay, Boychik? All right? Joseph said he'd think about it, but it didn't take long. He asked me to cancel the trip. I knew that the situation with his parents must weigh heavily on his mind. I thought Jews were family-minded, watching out for their own and all that. One evening after dinner, as we sat on the balcony watching the sun setting over the ocean, I said, you have to make amends with your mum and dad. You know that, don't you? You can't go on like this. And I can't stand you being so sad all the time. They need to know what's going on. And that you have a daughter, for goodness sake. Just give them a call, please. He shook his head. I've told you before, you don't know them. However, a week later, Joseph came home from work and announced that he had written to his parents while he was at work and he was going to go ahead with the surgery, whether they came or not. I shivered, feeling fear at my spine. This open-heart surgery, it was all new. Not much had been really proven in the medical field at that time. I was afraid, so I went to see Dr. Ivans without Joseph. I asked him straight out what the chances of survival were with this new valve procedure. He had to think about it for a few minutes before answering. Well, you know, we have to consider Joseph's problem. We don't know much about his history, do we? I mean, if we could get hold of his medical records so far, it would help. But from what I gather, Joseph doesn't want us to contact his former doctor or his parents. So, under those circumstances, from what I see of his heart's condition right now, I'd say, well, I'd say he hesitated. 50-50? 50-50? I echoed. That's not good, is it? So what's the alternative? He could be working at his place. Or could be on the beach. Could be playing bingo. Then he's gone. A massive heart attack. That would be it. At least he has a chance with this valve replacement. I knew I had to be the strong one now. I decided I would pretend calmness, practice yoga when I had a quiet movement. I wanted to sit down and cry out, why, Joseph? Why? Then I remembered the anecdotes I'd learned. Laugh and the world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. As my friend had said, it's always darkest before the dawn. All those little sayings that came from someone who had troubles, like you. Also, wasn't anxiety supposed to stop a mother's milk? Not so with me. I even had to express it every day for the milk bank, which was an unpleasant procedure, to say the least. Someone came daily to collect it in the sterilized bottles provided. If only I had my sister to talk to, I thought. Pauline was in Kenya. Better than Ghana, she'd said. But now there were terrible problems with the Mau Mau terrorists. They were attacking British settlers in the Rift Valley, just north of Nairobi. She said one of their Shamba boys, a Kikuyu, who wouldn't join the Mau Mau when he was asked, was taken away in the middle of the night. She said she believed they killed him. It seemed they, too, were living in a nightmare surrounded by tribes with vicious intentions to wipe out the elite British, who thought that they would bring commerce and business to their country. I would have appreciated Pauline's support. She was my sister. I mean, advice and companionship. Because Joseph was changing from a happy-go-lucky person to someone with the weight of the world on his shoulders. We lived in a silent world for a few days until a letter came back from New York. His folks were coming to visit. It was obvious to me I would be the outsider in their world. They were Jewish. I was a Shiksa. They had told me I had no right to marry their son, and they had disowned him because he married me. But I was glad that they were coming. The Levines flew from New York 1 week before the surgery. It was March. Joseph's cousin Eva and Al, they were at the hospital. Aunt Cecilia and Uncle Louis. It was obvious that Joseph was elated to have his family around him, and they were all gracious to me, although quite frankly, I didn't know that they really didn't care about me. I had to convince myself they did, and that after all, I was a wife. It took 3 days to prepare Joseph for surgery with special diet and medicines. I was horrified to learn that for the surgery, the heart would be stopped. Joseph would be connected to a heart-lung machine. Although this surgery took place in 1964, this machine, which does the work of the heart and lungs during open-heart surgery, is still in use today. My friend and former neighbor Edith agreed to look after Jenny, who suddenly had to be bottle-fed with my milk, expressed early in the mornings, for her daytime feeds. My parents now had a telephone, and I called them to tell them the date. March 17th, I said, St. Patrick's Day. At 6 a.m. at the Long Beach Hospital in California, Joseph handed me his glasses as he was taking away on the gurney. As I bent to kiss him, he said cheerfully, "See you in a few hours, honey." But it wasn't just a few hours. 6 hours later, one of the nurses came to our little group in the waiting room. They asked if anyone had O-positive blood. Could we donate? The nurse in charge was reluctant to take my blood because of my recent pregnancy. Joseph's uncle volunteered. Luckily, we were O-positive. Over the loudspeakers came an announcement, requesting blood donors O-positive immediately. Was this for Joseph, I thought? Could this really be happening? If his heart had stopped and was attached to this device, did it mean they were reviving him? I didn't know how all that worked. At 7 p.m. that evening, Joseph had been in surgery for 13 hours. I finally went to the hospital chapel. Obviously, something was very wrong. I had a raging toothache. I felt weak from giving blood so soon after the birth. My breasts were swollen and leaking milk through my bra and blouse. I sat in the chapel in a stupor, wondering why I was there. Was there really a God? And if so, would he forgive me for not believing? For the first time in many years, I knelt and prayed. "Please," I said. "I know I've not really trusted you, but if you are there, let my husband live. It will be proof to me that you exist." My prayers were interrupted by a voice over the loudspeaker. "Will Mrs. Levine please come to the administration office?" Three surgeons stood up as I walked into the small room. Their faces were as green as the scrubs they still wore. After a moment, one of them spoke. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Levine. He's gone." Like a crazy woman, I said, "Gone? Gone where?" One of the surgeons led me to a chair. "We tried for so long," he said, laying a hand on my shoulder. "His heart was too calcified to hold the valve. I'm so sorry we tried." At that moment, I wanted to block everything out. All I could say was, "No, no, no." I rose quickly and fled out the door, down the corridor, out into the ground. I kept running round and around until Joseph's Uncle Louis appeared. He stopped me. I was still shouting, "No." I remember he slapped my face hard. Then he held me to him for a moment before leading me back into the hospital. I said, "I want to see him." One of the nuns said, "No, dear, that would not be a good idea." I must have screamed that I wanted to see him because suddenly I was looking down at the lifeless body of the man I loved. That was the very worst thing I have ever experienced. I knew beneath the sheet that covered his body there would be a ruined chest. I kissed his cold forehead and whispered, "I love you." I would remember that moment forever. When I've mentioned this to people since that day, they all say that would never be allowed to happen. Not for me to see my dead husband in the morgue, just after surgery. But it did happen on that terrible St. Patrick's Day so long ago. On the way from the hospital, with Joseph's father at the wheel, we sped through the city in silence. The sun was just setting, illuminating the buildings with a glow of pink. When we stopped at the traffic lights, I opened the window to get some air. It was hard to breathe. On a wire above the road, there was a small bird singing his heart out. Even above the noise of the traffic, I heard it. I rolled the window up quickly, thinking, how could a bird sing at a time like this? On a day like this, how could it? I can still see that little bird, its tiny body outlined against the orange sky. I knew I had to call my parents. It was early morning in England. My father answered the phone. Before he could say anything, I blurted out, Joseph died, he's gone. I wept into the phone, he's gone. There was silence before my father said, yes, Amelia, I know.
How do you know?
I whimpered. Your mother woke up just after 3 this morning. Strangest damn thing. She sat up and said, Joseph died.
Oh my God, I said, how would she know?
Well, it was about 7 your time in the States, wasn't it? Isn't that when he died? I thought back about the time. I was in the chapel and realized it would have been that time when the heart-lung machine was disconnected and Joseph had taken his last breath. My mother knew before I did. It was then the memories came back. Of course she knew. My mother was a mystic. She talked to the dead. She would have known. I don't remember raiding the medicine cabinet that night. I took most of the sleeping pills Joseph's had provided during my pregnancy. I'd always found it hard to sleep. My in-laws, unable to wake me in the morning, had called an ambulance. When I woke up in a hospital bed, I was facing the sour expression of my doctor. Why would you do that, Amelia? I thought you were a strong girl. You've got a baby to look after. Oh, sod off, I said. Dr. Stilling ignored that and went on to tell me that Joseph's parents had arranged for shipment of his body. He would be on the same plane with them on their way back to New York. I was furious. How dare they take him away? But they did. And 3 days later, I flew alone to New York, wishing the plane would crash. One of Joseph's sisters met me at the airport, and the next day we all went to the family plot at Wellwood Cemetery on Long Island. Joseph was buried, and everyone threw stones on top of the grave. Not a flower was to be seen, and this horrified me even more. Joseph loved flowers. It was all very bizarre. As is custom at Jewish funerals, we sat shiva. The mirrors were covered with cloth. Neighbors bring in food. The talk is constant among people there. The Levines and their Jewish friends talked, wailed. It was awful. I was ignored, except when Joseph's father took me aside and quietly announced that they were going to adopt Jenny. She would be Esther, the daughter of Joseph, and they would raise her as the Jew she was meant to be. I was not fit to be a mother. For some reason, I found myself nodding. They were right. What did I have to offer her now, and how would I manage without a husband? Being a single mother was not what I wanted. I would be able to visit her when I wanted to. It might be for the best. A lawyer drew up all the papers for the adoption. We all drove into the city, and his parents even smiled at me from time to time. Everything was in order, and when the lawyer called me into his office after asking the Levine to leave us for a minute, he motioned for me to sit opposite him at his desk. He hesitated before speaking, seeming to study my face. Finally, he said slowly, "You do know that you will not be allowed to see your daughter ever again." "What?" I said, "Why ever not?" I was trying to comprehend his words. "Because you'd want her back, that's why." He looked at me intently. It would not be right for Mr. and Mrs. Levine, since they would be living for her, you know that. She's their main concern now. She's the daughter of their son, whom they worship. So you can see why they made this stipulation. I sat there for a few minutes, trying to put my mind in order. Could I give up my daughter? Could I really do that? Joseph's daughter? To people I didn't even like? No. Of course I couldn't let my daughter go. Never could I be parted from the only thing I had left of him. The Levines were heartbroken. Our son is dead because of you. We could have taken care of him, they said. If he was under a doctor's care in New York, he would have survived. On and on, the incrimination surfaced from these two bewildered parents. The thought came to my mind, watching their lives crumble, that I was leaving a trail of distraught parents. Colin's mother, now the Levines. Was I responsible for the death of yet another man in my life? If so, was there going to be an end to the guilt? Been listening to 9 o'clock Horses. This is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. Thank you for listening.